Hi, I'm David Rutledge, and on RN, you are in the Philosopher's Zone. The third movement of Haydn's Cello Concerto in D, for many people, a typical cultural product of 18th century Western Europe. It was composed in 1783, and like a lot of Haydn's compositions, it's logical, it's four square, it holds its emotions in check, and yet still possesses a kind of sunny optimism. In other words, a perfect musical expression of the European Enlightenment. Or is it? The standard account of the Enlightenment is that it represented the moment at which Europe woke from the slumber of the Dark Ages, put its thinking cap on, got busy with science, and started to question this whole religion thing. But according to today's guest, it's all a little bit more complicated than that.
The idea that you can somehow look back through history and pick all of these people who were on the side of reason and against superstition is just a complete nonsense.
Peter Harrison is director of the Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities at the University of Queensland. And while we're not going to get into a big stoush this week around science versus religion, what Peter has to say about religion and rationality and so-called enlightenment values has a very important bearing on his job as an academic in the humanities. There's a perception these days that the humanities are in desperate trouble and that to get disciplines like philosophy and history and literature out of trouble, they need a good dose of scientific method. And that's what we're talking about today, beginning with the question, are the humanities in crisis? And if so, why?
My view is that for the most part, they're not. And in this country, for example, just a couple of years ago, there was a survey done of humanities and social sciences capacity in Australia, and it showed a quite interesting pattern. And the pattern was something like 65% of undergraduate students are enrolled in degrees in the humanities and the social sciences. About 35% of our students, 13,000, will be doing majors in the humanities and the arts. If we think about the research outputs that our universities produce, again, our universities typically produce about one-third of the research overall in the humanities area and at a level that's rated very highly. So if we look at those sorts of statistical patterns, what they suggest is that although there has actually been a very slight drop in enrolments in, say, the BA, the Bachelor of Arts program, for the most part, student interest has held up very strongly. And if you look at the state of the discipline itself, in terms of people involved in research and teaching in the humanities, it's a very vibrant culture. The question then, I think, will be, well, where do the doom and gloom stories about the humanities come from? And I think there's a couple of sources there. First of all, I think that the conditions of teaching in the humanities have changed somewhat. So if we look, say, at the past 10 years, staff-student ratios in the humanities have become much larger and much larger in comparison to the sciences. There's been a casualisation of the workforce, a reduction in the number of senior people, so the senior people pick up greater administrative burdens. So those kinds of factors will feed into a narrative that says that there are some problems in the humanities. But those last ones, to some extent, are generic problems that are true of the university sector at large. And so the STEM disciplines will also be experiencing some of these difficulties as well. So what's the other aspect of why the humanities might be in crisis? Well, sometimes people in the humanities say that, and sometimes people outside the humanities say that. And those outside the humanities will say things like, the humanities have been hijacked by political correctness, by identity politics, by Marxist left-wing political agendas, and that this is the ruin of the humanities. And from within the humanities, the complaint will be, and I think to some extent justified, that education systems have instrumentalized the educational process. They've taken notions of human value out of it. They cease to see education as a way of forming character and producing good citizens, and rather see it as a training for the job market.
Well, let's go to that question of the job market, first of all, because that's a really interesting one, isn't it? What is a philosophy student, say, going to do maybe halfway through his or her undergraduate degree and starting to think about, what am I going to do when I finish this?
Good question. It's the mums and dads question that we always get on open days. You know, what use is the philosophy degree? There's a pretty good set of evidence that suggests that philosophy degrees, along with humanities degrees in general, are good at equipping students with critical thinking skills, with skills that enable them to approach a whole range of generic problems that students who might be skilled up in a specific area may not be able to deal with. So why might this be useful? It's useful because what I think we know about the future of the job market is that people will have a number of successive jobs in their careers, and the idea that you can train someone narrowly for a job that may not exist in 4 or 5 years, or that the particular student may choose to not to take up. In that context, what you want, I think, is training in a set of generic skills for which a philosophy education, I think, is terrific. As I would add, are a number of other degrees that are offered in the traditional humanities.
Well, when you mention identity politics and political correctness, maybe we can go back for a minute to this postmodern turn, quote unquote, that the humanities is said to have taken maybe the late 70s throughout the 80s. And you'll be familiar with the criticism there that what has happened is that the moral foundations of philosophy and related disciplines have been sort of rotted away by relativism and a fashionable sort of obscurantism, and that all of this has skewed the attention of graduates and faculty, I would say, away from foundational questions of morality and truth. Is that a fair claim?
Look, I think it's a fair claim in some respects, but you know, I think what we need to do is to focus on this term postmodernism, which I think covers a multitude of sins, as it were. And if we go to the question of relativism for a start, I think what we can say is that we live in a postmodern world. That's a fact. And the postmodern world means a world in which there's not a single monoculture, as, say, Catholicism in the Middle Ages, that determines essentially the truth of any question. Now, the consequence of that is a de facto pluralism of values, of religion, of moral values, of views about what life is about. That is the empirical fact. We're faced with this plurality of competing moral claims, religious claims. So the question then is, given that's the case, how do we understand that? How do we theorise that? What does this say about questions of ultimate truth? These are the questions that are acutely posed in the humanities. How do we account for the fact that there's a considerable degree of fundamental disagreements, not merely about moral values, but even the basic question of how you would set about resolving a fundamental moral question? So what the humanities, broadly speaking, have been able to do is to trace historically how this set of circumstances arose. How did we get to be in the postmodern condition, which is to say, a condition where we have this wide plurality of competing sets of values? Yet one obvious answer is, in the Western context, secularisation. So we no longer have a single religious authority or even a range of religious authorities helping us determine these fundamental moral questions. And as soon as you lose the capacity to have someone determining for you what your moral values ought to be and why you ought to subscribe to them, then I think to some extent, inevitably, you're going to get a plurality of values. Now, of course, the other aspect of this is the rise of the global village and our recognition that other cultures hold values quite different to our own, and that our own values are historically conditioned. So to put it another way, what the humanities, essentially the historical perspective of the humanities enables us to see is to how the values that we once thought were universal and applied to everyone have actually evolved in quite historically particular and unique ways. Now, to say that that is relativism, I understand why the accusation arises, but it's simply the fact that if we understand the realities of the historical origins of the views we hold, then we're in a position, I think, to relativise them. And that's essentially how the humanities has functioned. And that's the basis both of the accusation, that's the truth of the accusation, but I don't think it's a fair, in a way, it's not a fair claim to say, well, look, sorry, we're just pointing out how we understand the postmodern predicament in which we currently find ourselves.
On RN, you're in the Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest is Professor Peter Harrison from the University of Queensland. We're talking about the current health of the academic humanities. Let's bring the sciences into this at this point, because there's a certain, maybe you could call it a groundswell of opinion. Certainly the cognitive scientist Steven Pinker has been writing about this. And it's the idea that what could help the humanities is a little bit more science, a little bit more something that looks like scientific method, and that the humanities are hamstrung by a scepticism towards science that really shouldn't exist.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. And if we go back to the question of the postmodern predicament, as it were, what we have is these competing values, competing views of life, competing conceptions of what the ideal polity or political system should be. And what that seems to demand is, let's find the magic Archimedean point or the magic perspective from which we can resolve all of these problems. And as I said, historically, interestingly, this tended to be the religious establishment. Now the claim is made, interestingly, that science is the way in which we can actually resolve all these problems. Now, what's immediately obvious to me about this sort of situation is that it's really an attempt to revert back to a previous historical epoch where pluralism did not present the challenges that it currently does, where relativism does not present the challenges that it currently does, but it adopts the form of a kind of magisterial authority that is directly equivalent to that previously exercised by religion. Now, so the question we might want to ask is, well, what's wrong with reason, or as Steven Pinker would say, the Enlightenment? What's wrong with invoking these things to help us with the problems we face in terms of this vast plurality of competing values and so on? And I think the answer to that goes back to what I said previously, that somehow the notion that reason is this ahistorical, metaphysical, almost supernatural force that can solve these problems just doesn't stand up to the historical analysis of our very understandings of instrumental reason, which is to say, reason itself might posit itself as some sort of absolute universal metaphysical standard, but actually the various forms of reason arise in specifically historical ways, such that in our concepts of reason, and again this gets back to the relativism problem, our concepts of reason or our concepts of human rights or our concepts of values may not map on to those that we encounter in other cultures. And one solution to this is to say, well, they're all wrong and we're right, but we're doing that from within the perspective of a particular cultural tradition that, on a skeptical analysis, we pretend is universal, but actually is quite deeply historically conditioned by our Western intellectual heritage.
But from that, I mean, and I want to stay with Steven Pinker's point here that there's a certain, well, he calls it a kind of contempt towards the sciences coming out of humanities departments these days. And this is something that, I mean, in my own past as an academic, I was finding this in undergraduate essays. The kind of point that you're making being sort of simplified and translated into a sort of, well, reason and rationality are everything that's wrong. And if we look back over the 20th century, we see reason running rampant and nuclear holocausts and all the rest of it. Is that just woolly undergraduate thinking, or is that something that really is like a real strain of something at large within the humanities that's deeply problematic for an understanding of what science really is?
Look, I think there's a couple of quite different things here, and that woolly undergraduate understanding is not entirely misplaced. And so let's think about what some 20th century thinkers said about, say, an Enlightenment project of instrumental reason. And by instrumental reason, they mean reason applied to solve particular problems. Now, two very famous thinkers, Adorno and Horkheimer, at the very end of the Second World War, this is what they saw. This is what they saw. They saw a fantastic Western intellectual tradition that had been lauded as just one of the greatest human cultural achievements. But this came after two world wars, the horrors of Nazism, and the spectre of these Marxist utopias in Russia and China. And for these thinkers, at that particular historical moment, all of those things were to be attributed to a reason that had been uncoupled from deep moral reflection. Now, I know that that's clearly not what Steven Pinker's on about, and there's no sense in which reason necessarily gives us these kinds of things. But at the time, it seemed to me not an unrealistic analysis. Certainly one that's open to contestation. Absolutely one that's open to contestation. But it's a discussion that I think is worth having. And that is to say, what are the positive historical outcomes and what are the negative historical outcomes of particular movements such as the European Enlightenment or the European Enlightenment, as we should say? And I think the difficulty is that for someone to claim, as Steven Pinker does, that all of the good things in the world are a consequence of the Enlightenment and none of the bad things, it's really a very, very simplistic view of history. And in order to make those kinds of claims, you need to have a degree of historical insight, I think, that, frankly, he is lacking. And it's the kind of insight you find in historians. And my suggestion is not that all historians are going to run this line that, you know, reason is the cause of all our woes, but I'm saying it's an issue that needs a sensible kind of discussion. Now, the second thing I'd say about the contempt, putative contempt for science in humanities, I don't think that's the case. I don't think that you find contempt for the sciences. In this institute in which we're located at the moment, some of our most important conversation partners are scientists. We're interested in having the conversation with scientists, and I think that's true for most people in the humanities who have a very positive view of the sciences. But I think what we would say is that the sciences do not provide us with the solutions to all of the hard questions that we have. And when scientists make the claim, and there are not many of them, frankly, who do, I should perhaps say when champions of the sciences make the claim that all we need to solve the world's problems is more science, that's when I think humanities people start to get a bit sceptical, because really the fundamental issues that face us as challenges have deep elements of values and traditions that we need to explore, and the humanities are crucial for that. And I think, if I might just follow on from that, what is sometimes constructed as anti-science within the humanities is simply the humanities doing their interesting work on looking at the historical origins of the sciences, understanding the sciences as human activities that are not perfect, that have their flaws, that have occasionally led us in ways that we probably shouldn't have gone. And if that's anti-science, then the humanities are guilty. But that's part of the job, I think, to understand these things as human activities with all of the flaws that inevitably will give rise to.
What do you make of this claim then, which is put forward by certain champions of science, that the kind of Enlightenment humanism that ideally informs a humanities education is actually not that far removed from the modern scientific worldview? If you consider the Enlightenment as a process by which Europe emerged from the shadows of medieval superstition and started thinking rationally about the world and the place of humans within the world, you can then take, you know, quite disparate figures like Kant and David Hume and Mary Wollstonecraft and George Eliot, put them all together as fellow travellers with Francis Bacon and Isaac Newton. It's a nice, inclusive picture. Does it bear scrutiny?
No. In a word, no. I mean, I think... For a start, I think if we go back to the origins of modern science, and this is a particular argument of mine, it's very clear that when science is getting up and running in the 17th century, not only are most of the scientific figures theists and Christian believers, but a set of fundamental, let's call them Judeo-Christian assumptions, are foundational in the enterprise. Science is not going to get up and running without the partnership of religion. In fact, it's religion that gives its legitimacy right through to the 19th century, when it starts to then spread its own wings and exist independently. So the idea that you can somehow look back through history and pick all of these people who are on the side of reason and against superstition is just a complete nonsense. Just over there, listeners, you won't be able to see it, but I'm pointing to the most recent biography of Isaac Newton by the professor of history of science at Oxford, Rob Iliffe. And essentially what this book is about is religion, Newton's religious interests, which And Newton wrote much more on religious topics than he did on scientific topics. So he's deeply steeped in this religious worldview, which is crucial to his science. And the idea that somehow separating these things out and putting them in opposition to each other is the solution to our problems is simply ahistorical and naive, I think.
So when someone like Steven Pinker then says that the moral worldview of any scientifically literate person is not blinkered by religious superstition, are you saying that we can't really jettison those religious conceptions of meaning and value and still have good science?
Well, look, that's a good question, and let's parse it this way. Science today operates on a principle of what we'd call methodological naturalism. So good science does not invoke supernatural explanations. That's how it works. And what we know is that this seems to be the best way for science to operate. So in that sense, I think science leaves a whole set of important religious claims aside when it's doing its crucial work. Okay, and that's part of what gives science its kind of universality and liberates it from, to some extent, specific cultural expectations. So in that sense, it's a very interesting activity. But behind that question, I think, is why we should pursue science at all. What do we want to get from it? What are the values that we want science to help us achieve? What are the goals that we want science to help us accomplish? Science itself cannot answer those questions. And the other fundamental question is, what is it about the intelligibility of the world that makes science possible at all? Which is a basic philosophical question, I think. And again, there's been talk amongst a few particular prominent scientists that we don't need philosophy anymore. Well, that's just complete nonsense. Of course we need philosophy. Science is not possible without deep philosophical reflection. And that doesn't mean that all of our scientists need to be philosophers any more than they need to be paid-up theists. But science doesn't rule out the kind of deep questions that both religion and philosophy seek to answer. And indeed, the viability of science as a project, I think, depends on answering questions that science itself doesn't ask and that we need to seek resources for elsewhere, namely in things like philosophy or in religious traditions or in other aspects of culture that lie outside the sciences themselves.
Well, let's just finish up by circling back to where we started and the values of humanities education. In some ways, you know, this is an interesting sort of armchair discussion we're having, but in other ways you could say that it's a really, really urgent discussion given the place of science in the world today. Do you think that part of a really good, a well-rounded humanities education then should include, really should be, the study of science and the history and philosophy of science?
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't have put it better myself. One of the difficulties of the modern university education, I have to say more so in the sciences than in the humanities, is the increasing degree of specialisation. I think this is why very often when scientists move out of their lane and start talking about other things, they embarrass themselves. And it's a necessary byproduct of the highly specialised training. Science has been successful because it's focused on specific and quite narrow questions. And that's why the training is oriented in that way. But to some extent also, I think, in the humanities themselves, because the fundamental questions that face us today, the big questions, the wicked problems, require collaborative enterprises amongst scientists and indeed amongst scientists and humanities scholars. I think a crucial part of the humanities education is to get some understanding in the sciences. And history and philosophy of science is a great way to do that. And equally, people studying the sciences need, I think, to get some understanding of the history of their discipline and some of the philosophical issues that are relevant to the practice that they're engaged in.
Peter Harrison, Director of the Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities at the University of Queensland. And that's it for the program this week. Don't forget to check our podcast archive if you haven't done that already. And you can find us online at abc.net.au/rn. Look for the Philosopher's Zone on the program menu. Our producer is Diane Dean, executive producer Joe Gelonesi. Studio engineer this week was Tim Jenkins, and I am David Rutledge. Thanks for your company. Bye for now.